TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Jim White, Sea Level Rise and the Melting of Sea Ice and Glaciers. On the most recent TUC Radio program, you heard Dr. Jim White present answers to the most commonly asked questions from climate change deniers. And you can find his helpful and intriguing comments as free download on TUC Radio's website at tucradio.org. In this part of his talk, Dr. Jim White turns his attention to ice, the accelerated melting of the Arctic sea ice and the ice caps of Greenland and Antarctica. Dr. White teaches at the University of Colorado. He specializes in global change, paleoclimate dynamics, and the human impact on climate. As paleoclimate scientist, Dr. White addresses those who belittle the effects of warming. He says that in Earth history, on average, every degree of temperature change is about 20 meters off sea level. That's a huge number, he says. Concentrations of carbon dioxide after water vapor, the most important greenhouse gas, are measured in parts per million. The organization 350.org expresses in its name that to be safe from catastrophic climate change, we should not go over 350 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. However, in late 2016, the measurements at Mauna Loa, Hawaii, went over 400 parts per million for the first time in modern history. And on March 9, 2017, the reading was 405 parts per million. When a visionary scientist, Charles Keeling, began daily readings of carbon dioxide from Mauna Loa in 1958, the concentrations were only 318 parts per million, and the pre-industrial age normal was 280 parts per million. Here's Professor Jim White. He spoke at the annual Weather and Climate Summit to an audience of weathercasters and meteorologists from the U.S. and Canada. They met in Breckenridge, Colorado, from January 8 to 12, 2017.
So I want to focus on ice. There's two simple answers here. One is sea levels rising, and will continue to rise to levels that are frankly shocking. Right? You know, when I talk in public, people will say, can you give me some idea of what it means for sea level rise? And I say, yeah, there's no more Miami Beach, and there's no more Miami, and there's no more Norfolk. And, you know, they look at me like I'm a little weird. No, they look at me like I'm a lot of weird. Because that's very difficult for people to digest, very difficult for them to comprehend. And I think one of the educational components that we need to do much better at is really educating people about this is how your planet functions. Your planet trades land, ice, and ocean all the time, and not in small amounts. Okay, and I'll try to quantify that for you. We do, however, need far better information on how fast it will occur and ultimately how far sea level will rise. But in red here is important. We know that it will rise and to levels that it will cause unprecedented damage and costs in the future. The second is sea ice is rapidly shrinking, and that is a potential weather trigger. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, Jennifer Francis spoke here. We've had her out a couple of times. There's a whole community now of scientists who look at polar change and try to map polar change into change that we see down here in the continental United States and at 30, 40 degrees north. And the evidence is getting stronger and stronger that as the energy balance of the Arctic changes, that impacts the weather that we have down here. It impacts how the jet stream functions. It impacts how rapidly storms move or how slowly storms move. It impacts how far cold air can exit out of the Arctic region. So there's a lot of things that are happening, and you all know this. The last 5 to 10 years have seen some rather unusual weather events And I think that that's just, you know, we got to sort of buckle our seatbelts, put our tray tables up and go, okay, this is what's going to happen. We sort of figure out why and what's going to happen in the future, but I don't think there's any reason to expect that to change because the energy balance of the Arctic is changing quite a bit. Why am I so confident in all that? One is that water has a tipping point, or ice has a tipping point. It's either ice at 32 or it's water at zero. And tipping points within the climate system are really important. When you hit a tipping point, you can have very rapid change. Whether you have snow on the ground, you know this, whether you have snow on the ground and therefore you have more reflectivity, or whether it rained and you have water that goes into the soil, is very different. It's going to make a big difference to the weather for the next several days, and indeed it's going to make a big difference to the weather for the next several months in terms of the climate. Second, warm water and warmer air melt ice. Right? This is how it functions. Third, warm water does expand, so there is a thermal expansion component of sea level rise. And fourth, it's physics. Right? This is not something you get to believe in. This is one of these things. Right? All of these things are going to happen. Polar changes are important to watch. This was discussed the other day. Why? Because polar amplification makes changes larger, easier to see, and the poles are where we expect to see changes first. All right, so in 2016, I pulled this off of NOAA, the Arctic had its warmest year on record. And that's driven by several factors. One is a decreasing sea ice, trading white ice for blue ocean, is a very, very big albedo effect, very, very big heat storage effect. And second, snowfall, as particularly in the shoulder months of the spring and the fall, when you have less snow in October and November, you have more heating, and you have less snow in April, you have more heating. And so those shoulder months are really important. As a paleoclimatologist, as a paleoscientist, we can track this over time. This is the way the planet has behaved for as far back as we can actually see. That if you look at, for example, that 2-degree change I told you 3 to 5 million years ago was a 6-degree change in the Arctic. That 4-degree change that you saw with NOAA Antarctica was about a 12, 15, 16-degree C temperature change in the poles 40 million years ago. Right? So these are very big changes in the Arctic. And that factor of 3 or so, we call the polar amplification factor, has been active for a long time. And the reason why it's active is because it's basically physics. So you see snow cover changing over time. You guys know what that does. I won't talk much more about this, but permafrost is also decreasing. So permafrost is frozen land. We've had, for the last 10,000 years, some pretty stable temperatures on the planet. And they included a large chunk of Canada and a large chunk of Russia that were frozen. In those systems, in those really cold systems, it thaws out enough in the summertime that you get some photosynthesis. So there's land plants that they grow up there. But then during the wintertime, when normally you would have respiration and that carbon going back up into the atmosphere, which happens here at 40 degrees north, that's not the way it works when you get that far north. It freezes up, and that carbon gets stored for the most part. And so really cold regions of the planet tend to store carbon over time. And indeed, permafrost has stored carbon at a rather large amount. There's about as much carbon stored in permafrost as there is in all coal, oil, and natural gas put together. And that's frozen. And that has that 32-degree mark set into it. It doesn't all freeze at once. You know, the good news is the physics still applies. It takes a long time to melt this stuff. You know, you start melting it to the surface, and you melt it down, and you melt it down, and you melt it down. It takes probably 100 years or more to melt permafrost. But once it's melted and accessible to bacteria who love to munch on this carbon, then this carbon starts to come out. It comes out as CO2, comes out as methane. We can talk about that more. But this is one of those feedbacks that as a carbon cycle scientist, we worry about quite a bit. It may be that, you know, what we do as human beings starts to get overshadowed by what the planet, by what the natural carbon cycle does as the permafrost systems begin to warm up. So trading seawater for land ice, this is how your planet works. What I've plotted here now, when I plotted, I stole this from Foster and Rowling in a Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, is CO2 and sea level. And you see CO2 varying from about 280 parts per million to about 180 parts per million. And that was the last, that's the glacial, interglacial kind of change. You go from about 280 parts per million down to about 180 parts per million. It's about 100 ppm change. By the way, I mean, you can do the math really quickly. So 280 to 400 is bigger than 100. And so we've actually increased CO2 in the atmosphere more than the CO2 decrease that accompanied the large glaciations on the planet. Now, those large glaciations weren't driven entirely by CO2. As a matter of fact, they were driven predominantly by changes in the Earth's orbit around the sun, which gave us less sun. But CO2 was a contributing factor. You see the very good relationship here between CO2 and sea level. Now, the scale here on the right is the one I want to focus your attention on. Zero is today's sea level. So when it got colder, that 6 degrees cooling on the planet that I talked about was about 120 meters of sea level drop on the planet. So you took about 120 meters out of the ocean of water, and you made it into Antarctica, and you made it into Greenland, and you made it into the Laurentide ice sheet, and you made it into the Finno-Scandinavian ice sheet, large chunks of ice. That was a very large change there. You also see that at various times in the past, sea level has been about the same as it is today. It's been maybe a couple meters lower, maybe a couple meters higher. The Eocene, about 40 million years ago, you've got about 80 meters higher sea level and about 4 degrees warmer. I've talked about this in the past, and this is one of my most, you know, I want to get out to the public messages. That 10 degree C temperature change that we had on the planet was accompanied by a 200 meter sea level change. All right, so you go from today into the past, 6 degrees colder, 120 meters. You go from today into the future, 80 meters, 4 degrees. So the scaling is not linear, but it's important to recognize that the, on average, every degree of temperature change is about 20 meters of sea level. That is a huge number. But that's what the planet does. Right? To the planet, this is no big deal. This is what we do on a regular basis, folks. This is how we handle things. Right? I think it's us as human beings who have built large cities. We've built huge amounts of infrastructure right on the coast, thinking that that sea level was going to stay where it was. No, it doesn't. Right? Whether we make the changes or whether the planet makes the changes, it doesn't really matter. The fact is that sea level is a very dynamic thing on this planet. Jim.
Jim Gandy at WLTX in Columbia, South Carolina. The sea level, that rise, that change, over what time period did that change take place?
I'll talk about that in a second. So we know that as you take CO2 out of the atmosphere down to around the 180, 200 parts per million level, planet cools off quite a bit, ice sheets can grow. You also see on here probably one of the more disturbing messages in here, and that is that somewhere around 600 to 800 parts per million in the atmosphere of CO2 is when you have Antarctica as an ice mass or you don't, or you have 80 more meters of sea in the ocean. Right? So one of the more interesting questions is that we've watched Antarctica form, but we've not watched Antarctica go away. So Antarctica forming, all right, when you reach that 800, 700 ppm threshold, that got cold enough that you started to develop Antarctica. All right? Now, does that mean that when you reach 700, 800 ppm in the atmosphere, you start to melt Antarctica? And that's a fundamental question and one that I don't think we know the full answer to. Although, you know, if it went one way, I think, you know, precautionary principle would say, all right, it's probably going to at least be in the ballpark going in the other direction. We're at 400 today. Will we make 600? Will we make 700? Easily. I mean, if we don't change the way that we're doing things, we'll easily get to 600, 700, 800 parts per million. Right? We can make 1,000 parts per million. And we can do that in a far shorter period of time than we give ourselves credit for. You know, my kids, if they use energy the way that my generation used energy, they will need all of the coal, oil, and natural gas that we have in order to do that. And so you could very easily change the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere by large amounts. So this is an important. So the other important thing to look on there is there's an amount of land ice on the planet that is dynamic, that can change quite a bit. And that's 14 meters. Once you go to, this is what's called the marine-based ice, and it can waste fairly rapidly. 14 meters is, again, something that's a problem. Right. So a little bit more about marine-based ice. So there are parts of both Greenland and Antarctica that the base of the ice sheet is below sea level. That's unstable, what we call metastable. So this is particularly true in West Antarctica. Most of West Antarctica would be an ocean if the ice went away. Now you might ask, well, how do you even get ice there in the first place, right? So, and the answer to that is twofold. One is that, remember, 20,000 years ago, sea level was 120 meters lower. So a lot of these large land ice masses grew at that time, and there was no sea level to bother them at that time. And then as the deglaciation occurred, as the Laurentide melted and all these other ice sheets melted, sea level rises, and you create what we call a metastable situation, where now you've got land ice that has its base below sea level. And it would, at some point, like to just dump that ice into the ocean and get back to what we would think of as a normal situation where the ice is floating in the ocean, or the ice is melted into the ocean. And there's about 14 meters of that. Okay. This, I think, gets more towards, we're going to see in the second talk of the day, the declining ice mass in Greenland now. This is from the GRACE satellite. GRACE is a gravity-measuring satellite. And the gravity-measuring satellites, I think, is some of the best stuff that we have. It measures mass. And a lot of other satellites, if you measure the surface of an ice sheet, that surface of the ice sheet can vary depending on the density of the snow. So if you had you can make that surface go way up, but if you make it go way up with very light snow, there's not a whole lot of mass there. So I think mass is the thing to measure, and GRACE has, I think, helped us out quite a bit. Now, back to your question, Jim, about sea level rise in the past. Basically, as our planet has warmed up, the rate with which sea level is rising has increased, and that's perfectly sensible. That's physics. That's the way it ought to work. But we're seeing rise rates here of about 3 millimeters per year over the last 10 years, 15 years or so. That's actually relatively small compared to what the planet has been capable of doing in the past. So if you look at the deglaciation, you look at how rapidly was sea level rising throughout that time period, rates that are in the neighborhood of three times faster than that, 10 millimeters per year, are typical. And there are periods when you've got large chunks of ice that destabilize. We don't know exactly where these things are, but large chunks of ice that destabilize and go into the ocean rapidly, meltwater pulses, they're called. And they happen two or three times during the deglacial. So sea level crawls along at this 10 rate, and then we'll go up to 40, 50. So 10 times faster than today. And this is something we've talked about in the past. We're looking at something like a meter sea level rise over the next 100 years or so. That's sort of a conservative, this is what's going to happen. A meter in 100 years is something that, yes, we ought to really care about because it is really significant for coastal communities. But it's hard to get people really excited about that, even at that level. A meter in 30 years, that's a mortgage. A meter in 30 years is much more significant. And we think that that's pretty much the sort of the typical rate that the planet does when it starts to shed ice. And so this 14 meters, we think, rates of roughly a meter in 30 years, let's say 3 meters in 100 years, is probably what we ought to think of as sort of an average rate coming in the next few centuries. There are, of course, tipping points along the way there. The Federal Flood Insurance Program we could talk about. Either that's going to be the largest entitlement program on the history of the United States, or it's going to have to go away. Property values, this is a really significant issue. When you can no longer get insurance, what happens to the value of homes near the coast? And we know this. It's humans, we don't tend to do things in a nice linear fashion. This is more than likely going to be a run on the market kind of situation. So we need to keep an eye on that. And then, the people who actually know about this think about power. They think about roads. They think about sewers. And they think about freshwater availability. Many coastal communities still pull groundwater out of the ground for their drinking water. And as the ocean rises, the salt lens moves inland. And we've already seen many coastal communities having to go farther and farther inland for their fresh water. The estimate is that there's going to be about 150 million refugees by the end of this century. And certainly billions of refugees in the years after that. Right? I'm not saying those numbers to be shocking or to be provocative. I think these are pretty conservative kind of numbers. Now, what does 13 meters of sea level look like? This is Bangladesh with 13 meters of sea level. This is, you know, one of those areas of the world that we care about from a refugee point of view. There are hundreds of millions of people who've got to go somewhere, and they don't really have anywhere to go. It's the reason why the Defense Department cares quite a bit about climate change and sea level rises. They recognize that these sorts of things are very destabilizing. This is Sacramento with 13 meters of sea level rise. So the good news is that California is going to get a whole lot more water to grow a whole lot more crops. Bad news is they're going to have to build a dam somewhere, you know, in the San Francisco area to keep seawater from going into this part of the world. Florida with 13 meters of sea level rise. And then Maryland and Delaware with 13 meters of sea level rise. Delaware approaches, you know, whether we ought to just say, okay, we give up, we'll go to 49 states, and we'll just let that one go by the wayside. A new Arctic is here. The disappearance of summertime Arctic sea ice is faster than anticipated and has had profound changes in tourism, has profound changes in shipping. So today, for example, we see lots of ships that sail across the Arctic every summer. This is the, and I've spoken about this in the past, and this is one of the things I talk about quite a bit when I give public talks. It's an intergenerational issue. So we put the 400 ppm CO2 there. Even if it just stopped there, let's just say by whatever political or economic means, we stopped at 400 ppm CO2. Our kids and our grandkids are still going to have to deal with the energy that 400 ppm CO2 wants to put into the ocean. So sea level is going to rise no matter what. Right? The only way to stop that would be to take CO2 back out of the atmosphere. And even then, as we're talking about, have we triggered those ice masses, those unstable, that 14 meters, have we triggered that already, and can we stop that? And we don't even know whether or not we can stop that. Very quickly, the loss of old ice is important for a very important reason, and that is, so you see here in 85 and 2016, the amount of very old ice. That very old ice is important because annual ice is something that can come and go very easily. The Great Lakes is a good example of that. The Great Lakes used to freeze every winter, thaw out every winter, freeze every winter, thaw out every winter. I'm using Lake Erie here as an example. In 1973, on February 27th, Lake Erie was frozen over. It's all red. 2 weeks later, it's melted out. You know, that's that 32 degrees Fahrenheit, that 0 degrees C threshold. So as soon as you've got enough warm water eating away at it, warm air eating away at it, a little bit of wind action. My message to you is keep an eye on the Arctic because it is set up to change. And when it does change rapidly in the summertime, and you've got a lot more heating in the summertime than you had before, then you're going to see some very interesting weather. You're going to see some very interesting phenomena that we haven't seen before, to be quite honest. So I keep an eye on that. Yeah. All right, finally, I just want to, so I always end talks, and I'll do this until I die. I want to talk a little bit about ethics. I want to talk about, you know, the reasons why we do these things. Because we live on a water planet, we've talked about this extensively now, the impacts come after the causes by about 50 years or more, and that creates an intergenerational problem. Right? So we say we love our kids, but do we show it? And the answer is no, to some degree. Right? If we understood, I think, the physics of the climate system, if we understood the delays in that system, we would understand this better. But the fact is that we are indeed saddling our kids and our grandkids with huge expenses. And we got a great life out of it. Right? I have a fantastic life because of the energy that was available to us as a society. But I don't think it's fair to leave the problems, the waste, if you will, to my kids. Right? Thought number two, population must be controlled. We don't talk about this, but this is something we need to talk about. So the best and most lasting way to deal with population, I've talked about this before, is to empower women economically and politically. And if you think about it, you know, as a human society, we males have dominated the system since time began. And the value of women in society still today in many third world countries is entirely around how many children she has. And there are parts of the United States where you can draw that correlation as well. Where women have political power, where they have economic power, two things happen. One is they tend to have fewer children per woman, And second, they tend to have those children later. Both of those things delay population growth and stabilize population. You don't need to do what China did, which is say you can't have any more kids. You can get to where you want to be by actually having more equity between men and women. And third, everyone has to care about a shared planet. As I pointed out, we got about 1.5 billion people without shelter. You got about 2 billion people who don't get enough calories or don't get the right calories. They're going to care about whether or not they can feed their kids. They are going to care about whether or not they can put shelter above their kids' heads. They're not going to care about what fuel they use. They're not going to care about whether they're cutting trees down. They're not going to care about the environment because they need to survive. So you cannot have a situation in which you've got 5 billion off here utilizing the planet the way we are and the 2 billion over here struggling to survive, because those 2 billion are going to change the face of the planet regardless of what the 5 billion do. So at some point, you've got to think about equity. You've got to think about, we need to bring everybody up to at least some point where they can care about our shared environment. All right? And so with those three thoughts, I will stop. Thank you so much for listening.
That was Dr. Jim White, director of the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado. He spoke about sea level rise and the melting of Arctic sea ice and Greenland and Antarctic glaciers. He spoke at the annual conference of the Weather and Climate Summit before meteorologists and TV and radio weathercasters. They met in Breckenridge, Colorado, from January 8 to 12, 2017. And you can find the YouTube channel of the Weather and Climate Summit online. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.